Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
This Monday.com ad was created by a team of people and AI agents. The agents wrote the copy and managed the timelines, while our human creative director made sure it all made sense. Easy. Create your own AI agent today on Monday.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Good day to you and a warm welcome in Camino with
Jamie Juicing and me, Kit Hogg, on this final day of January, the month you thought might never end. Big thanks to the inimitable Giles Brand for your Saturday morning energy bar. Now, if you are a long-time listener to Talk Radio Europe, you might remember David the Dogman, host of a popular show that went out at this time on Saturdays, all about our furry friends, not only dogs, but cats as well. Well, it's dogs we're talking about this morning, specifically how to make an English Bull Terrier's floppy ears pointy, why Brian Sewell sleeps with his dogs, and why, anyway, they are man and woman's best friends. Commensurate with the cold, wet nights that we're not used to, Janie tells us the history of the hottie, that would be the hot water bottle, and with temperatures at minus 10 degrees in need of a hot water bottle, no doubt. Kate Serkan sends us a letter from Kyiv in Ukraine. Time permitting, on the part of the show we call Things That Grow, I tell a tale of the Sitka spruce, known to most of us as the Christmas tree, and how the provenance of its timber became invaluable in building not only ships, but aeroplanes, the iconic World War II Mosquito, no less. And as the world becomes increasingly the stuff of a geopolitical prologue to Trumpian Armageddon, how prone are you to becoming consumed by doom-scrolling? And is it good for your health, that insatiable, hypnotic, even voyeuristic feeding frenzy of mind-boggling but indigestible news, keeping you awake at night like a late-night cheesy supper?
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
So, Janie, let's remember this extraordinary week, wet week.
Oh, it's been more than a week.
Yes.
It has not stopped raining since December, beginning of December. Literally.
Come on, it's not raining now.
No, it isn't today, which is why it's so wonderful.
It's a bit of a relief, isn't it?
It's such a relief. It's actually not raining, and it might not rain tomorrow, so that'll be good. We've got another beach clean-up happening tomorrow, with rubbish with the Eco Amigos, which I'm excited about. Last week's had to be cancelled.
Good on you. Well done, yep. Eco Amigos. Big shout-out to the Eco Amigos. I wonder, though, are we still technically in drought? Because it doesn't seem to matter how much rain falls. Some meteorological dude will always tell us that we're in drought. I don't know, possibly in Almeria or Murcia, where lack of water is a perennial concern.
I cannot believe we can possibly be still in drought, Kit. It's not possible.
Well, if anyone's got any stats on that, WhatsApp us on +3. Well, you probably know the WhatsApp. I'm going to read it anyway. 645-99-67-95. 645-99-67-95. Are we still technically in drought. But I'll tell you what, for my part, having lived here since 1998, I can say without doubt that this is the wettest, coldest winter I've experienced in Andalusia.
I would agree. Yes. I can't remember it, except that, I mean, the first year we came here, which was in 2003, it didn't stop raining through October. I do remember that.
Yes, I remember that being wet too, because we were moving house at that time. But, I mean, it did snow in our pueblo in December of 98. Great fat clods of semi-frozen slush plopping out of the sky with such aplomb that cork oak branches were shattered by the accumulating weight of snow. The bars full of revelers drinking cognac and aguardiente. And incredibly, and I think I've told this story before, forgive me, but people drove up from Marbella to shovel snow into the boots of their cars.
No. Really, why?
Well, they wanted to take it back down to Marbella to show their friends that
they
were
loaded up with Eskies, and they put them in their Eskies.
I don't know. No, I can remember people just opening their boots and shoveling it straight in.
It's ridiculous.
So how long it lasted, I don't know. But here's the thing. This winter has not been extraordinary, not by past standards at any rate. Talk to any of the old Campo folk around our way, and they will happily subscribe to the memory of three continuous winter months of precipitation, of white lime wash turning green, of pin mould pocked walls, of houses where the back door was open so the water could flow through the house, down the steps and out of the front door onto the street, while they sat around watching the water just to one side of this flow of water, around a kitchen table butane burner. You know those? I forget what they called them, stufas or something.
Yeah.
Heavy cloth swaddled around their waists, varicose veins hardening in their legs below the table. Welcome to the winter. But yeah. However cold, damp and leaky an old Spanish house can be, it's with gratitude that we can reflect a rebalance of the season. How? In overwarm, overdry winters, oranges and almonds blossom eerily before Christmas. Too early.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but I have seen the blossoms coming out now.
Yeah, now. It's fine. It's just in late January. Almond blossom, come out.
Yes.
It's now your time.
Yes.
Don't come out before Christmas, please.
Okay. Because it gives me the heebie-jeebies. And they have been in previous years, have they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I see.
And weirdness of oranges blossoming in November. You know, that should not be happening. But things kind of are rebalanced now. Forests and pastures drinking in all this provenance from the skies, how the lower temperatures are inhibiting pests and diseases. You'll notice that the hideous pine caterpillar, for example, there's far fewer nests in the trees this year.
Yes, I have noticed that, actually.
Because you've got a pine tree, haven't you, Jamie?
I do. We had three nests in ours, which we've disposed of.
But not this year?
Yes, this year.
Oh, I mean, like, when?
Before Christmas.
Oh, you had them before Christmas?
Yes.
Oh, well, that blows my theory out of the ground.
Sorry.
Anyway, you're rid of yours. I've certainly in the mountains, I haven't seen the number of pine caterpillar nests. But what's irrefutable is how beautiful a fiesta of flower and birdsong this spring will eventually
be. Oh, I can't wait. I really can't wait. I mean, the little yellow flowers are all over the place already.
Oh, the oxalis, yeah.
Yep. We've got the wild garlic has come up. It hasn't flowered yet.
Irises.
Yep, the irises are starting to come through. There's those beautiful white lilies.
Yeah.
They're coming up. My phacelis are nice and fat and juicy.
Oh, are your Cape gooseberries?
That's right.
Little vitamin C bombs, they are.
Oh, they are. But one of the my carob trees, which is quite a young one, has been bashed so hard by the wind, it's almost squashed the plant.
Oh,
it's bent at an angle of 45 degrees. I don't know if it's going to remain. And the tops of my papaya trees, Kit, have lost all their fruit, great big bulbous pieces of fruit, all landed on the ground, and one of the trees was topped, beheaded.
The wind has been extraordinary.
It's been
umbrella inverting gusts, and there are a few things more useless and ridiculous than an inverted umbrella. Pines torn from the ground, shed eucalyptus branches, mature castanos, cleaved in two. Yeah, big time. And yeah. But what, while we're on the weather, I just wanted to say that I took a walk up to the castle the other day to look down at the wide river valley that you can see all the way, goes down all the way to the sea and, you know, to Morocco and beyond. I mean, anyway, this massive river valley, which is normally dry as a bone, is full of wide, glossy water, the Hennal River, as abundant as a Mediterranean Limpopo.
Oh, how beautiful that must have been to see. I mean, a wonderful, wide, shiny, silvery ribbon going down. I've never seen that before.
Glassy it was, like a series of lakes, actually. So yeah, very nice to see.
But it wasn't so high, Kit, down at the bottom, that it would have flooded those houses
above? No, nobody got flooded in the Hennal, to the best of my knowledge. I think the Guadiaro people suffered. I think San Roque, there's been some flooding.
Yeah, yeah.
But generally, at this time of year, the waterways are clean already, and the rivers flow well. They're much more efficient drainage systems. One of the problems that we do have, though, Janie, is drying our clothes.
And, oh, my God.
Which brings us to that sacred ground called the laundromat.
Oh, the laundromat. I actually rather like going to the laundromat. I've got a very little house, excuse me, with small windows, and I feel like I've got cabin fever when it's bad weather because I can't see out, and it's a very small house. So going out to a very wide-windowed, you know, glassy laundromat is a treat.
Well, you can sit there and look at the view.
I can... No, it's not. It's just being somewhere different, really.
Ah, being somewhere different. Yes, yes.
Will you excuse me? I have to clear my throat.
Yes, do
will
that.
You just one second? I'll spare you.
La 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 la. No, she's gone over to the window to clear her throat. Right. Have you got a spittoon handy?
That's done. No.
Good throat.
No, that's done. Oh God, how awful that must have sounded. Anyway, so yeah, I've made regular trips out because there's not much I can do. I can't go out on my terrace. Because that gets wet, everything has been blown away and it's just a disaster area. And I mean, not many of us, I think, nowadays have dryers, do we, in our houses? Not here in Spain where we can dry things on an aerator outside.
And posh people do.
Posh people, oh, do they?
Definitely.
Okay.
Do you meet people at the laundromats?
Oh, I do, yeah.
Who have you met?
I meet people
who... Have you met any blokes?
Not ones that I would, you know, spend a lot of time with.
Okay, right. Just sitting there watching the clothes going round. You know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I met a lady the other day who's on a golfing holiday. Poor lady, her and her husband. They came to the laundromat to just be somewhere different.
Oh, really? Did they have any clothes with them? Or
yeah, yeah. They put their clothes in the washing machine and then in the dryer, and we sat there chatting away. And that was actually the day when I took my wet laundry there to dry, because I can't do it at home. Well, I could put it on little radiators, but it would take forever. And I put my money in the machine. And, you know, it's got these sort of arrows all over the place, you know, pointing upwards and leftwards and right. Well, I put it in the wrong machine, didn't I? I put my clothes in one machine, put the money in for the other machine, which was above it. That got an extra half an hour and I got nothing. My machine didn't go round at all. So what's the matter?
I don't know what to say, Janie.
I know.
Well, it turned out
the people whose machine I had boosted up with extra time were sitting outside in a van looking through the window at me, smiling. I thought, what's going on here? And they actually told me, you know, that was their machine. They would stop in half an hour, when the half an hour was up, their half an hour, which they'd just put in, and then I could put my stuff in and it could carry on.
Oh, that's nice. So you did have some humour and interaction.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. No, they're very friendly. And I had a half hour wait, and then I did that. And then the next time I go into the garage, another garage, and I see an empty machine. Right, OK, I'll go and get that. I run off to the office to buy my ticket to put in the machine, the little token, right? And I go back in and the machine's already in use. Someone else has used it. This lady comes in. She's got two, I find out she's got two disabled children, one who isn't disabled, and piles of washing. So she's had to use all four machines. So I have to wait until she's finished. So, you know, it can take a very long time to get your laundry dried sometimes.
I remember a laundromat I was in the Asturias, And there were six washing machines and only two drying machines. So I had a long wait there as well.
Yeah.
Because in the Asturias it rains a lot.
But you can put normally two washes into one machine because they're enormous.
But they were okay. I think we've exhausted laundromats.
We have. I'm so sorry. It's terribly boring. I actually enjoy laundry drying.
So moving on. The other night there was a power outage. Not a blackout, but dimming lighting, some circuits not working. Did you have one
in your village? No.
No, in our village, yeah. It was hardly surprising, really. So anyway, I ran up to the shop and joined my neighbours in the local buying candles and then went home and lit them, fairy lights flickering cosy atmospherically, just as a full wattage and the internet returned. And on the internet, I read Kate Serkan's column in an online newspaper called the Kyiv Independent, and she writes a column called Explaining Ukraine, and I just thought it would help put things into perspective to dip into that. She says, the lights are on as I write this. I know, not the most dramatic opening, but when you spent the past weeks rationing electricity like a Victorian counting coal, the simple fact of a functioning outlet feels worth noting. I'm not tethered to a dying power bank, frantically typing before the battery percentage drops into the red. I have, for this unpredictable window of time, the forgotten luxury of not thinking about the power at all. Which is to say, let's make the most of the electricity while I have it. Here in Ukraine, we're experiencing extreme rolling blackouts, the kind that leaves you with 2.5 hours of electricity on a good day. Mostly we deal with darkness, cold, and the particular frustration of trying to charge a laptop, keep food from spoiling, and in my case, entertain a 3-year-old. The elevator hasn't worked in 3 days. You're carrying groceries, a kid, or both, and your knees remember every flight. Or worse, you're in one of the newer apartment buildings, the kind designed with 21st century assumption about infrastructure in a so-called civilized world. Everything runs on electricity, heating, cooking, hot water. When the power dies, so does your ability to perform basic human functions. You're not just inconvenienced, you're immobilized. Then there's the impossible calculus parents perform, where they have to warm their child's milk rather than charge their phone. They have to run the washing machine to combat the ever-growing pile of dirty laundry before they can even think about finishing work. They cook when nobody's hungry because the schedule of electricity outages may change again, and then who knows what everyone will eat. The anger is rational. The exhaustion is real. But here's what I remember on those days when the anxiety spikes and the walls close in. There's a reason for this, and that reason has a name, a national flag, and a very specific location to the north. The only guilty party in all this is Russia. I keep returning to something a close friend said recently. Her husband just joined the military, and she's become their two small children's primary caregiver. I struggled with what to say to her when I learned the news, wondering if it's borderline obnoxious to ask, how are you, and feeling that any words of support might feel insufficient to what she's going through. I told her what felt both inadequate and necessary, that I'm here for whatever she needs, whenever she needs it. That asking for help isn't weakness, but strategy. A way to preserve the energy required for the long campaign of single parenting during wartime. She thanked me and then said something I haven't been able to stop thinking about. That she doesn't have the luxury to spend too much time worrying about the future because her children need her to be present, not paralysed. That's the thing about war as a chronic condition rather than an acute crisis. You don't get that release. The luxury of breakdown belongs to peacetime. Here, we metabolize the unbearable and keep moving, not because we're strong and resilient, but because stopping isn't an option. But here's what I need you to understand amid all this. The resilience narrative is a trap. When you read about Ukrainian resilience, you need to know none of us here are doing okay. We're functioning, which is not the same thing. We go to work because rent is still due. We go to parties because the alternative is staring at walls waiting for the next air raid siren. We maintain relationships, pursue careers, argue about restaurant choices, complain about traffic. All the ordinary friction of life continues because if we stopped to fully metabolize what was happening, we'd dissolve. We would become puddles of grief on the floor, unable to move. And that's not a metaphor. That's a real possibility we each avoid through sheer force of will and the accident of having obligations that won't wait. And on top of every wartime worry, where is the person I love? Will the power stay on? Will that sound be thunder or something worse? People still carry all the peacetime worries too. The difficult neighbours, the four failing relationships, the ageing parents, the children who won't sleep, the bills they can't pay. The war doesn't pause these problems. It just makes them harder to solve and less appropriate to mention in social circles. And so we continue, not because we're resilient, but because stopping means drowning. And we've decided collectively, stubbornly, perhaps foolishly, that we'd rather stay afloat until the day we can finally breathe again. Until then, we tread water and call it living. Yeah, and that's from Kate Serkan, and she's writing in the online publication Kyiv Independent, which is daily news from Ukraine. Independent journalism, never easy, but these guys are doing it in wartime.
And it puts some of our troubles, pales them into insignificance.
Doesn't it? Anyway, if you want to support them and receive their newsletters, then Google the Kyiv Independent. We're going to take a break now, and after these messages, we're going to talk about dogs.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Welcome back. The steep little street I live on is notable for the number of dog turds you need to step around. And that, unsurprisingly, is due to the number of dogs that live there. Not all of them barking all of the time, but by my reckoning, outnumbering us humans possibly by 2 to 1. But have you ever wondered, what is the origin of dogs? I mean, I know they come from wolves, but why have they become our best friends? And, you know, it's kind of a weird symbiosis, us and them, the two hyper-predators that are man and canine. Well, who said it first? No one knows. But Frederick the Great, warrior, ruler and enlightened despot of 18th century Prussia, said it well. The only absolute and best friend a man has in this selfish world, the only one that will not betray or deny him, is his dog. Relations between dogs and people are so normal and pervasive as to pass almost unregarded. Yet, viewed objectively, this affiliation is among the most peculiar in the animal kingdom. Somehow, the descendants of a large and dangerous predator, the grey wolf, have integrated themselves into human society in a manner unmatched by any other species. Domesticated animals abound, but most exist only to serve. I mean, well, you've got cattle, sheep, goats, buffalo, yaks, horses, asses, pigs, ducks, geese and chickens. They all yield food, transport or materials. Cats, it's true, have inveigled their way into people's feelings, where they provide a certain level of companionship beyond their working role as mousers. But dogs are different. They are true and trusted friends, even those that are servants. Moreover, such servants, sled dogs, sheep dogs, hunting dogs, guide dogs, are skilled operatives and not mere drudges. They collaborate in a sophisticated and willing manner with their masters and mistresses in ways that no other domestic animals can manage. How this strange symbiosis came about is now being pieced together. Clues come from disciplines ranging from genetics and psychology to archaeology and anatomy, and places as far apart as China, Germany, Alaska, and Australia. One of the most telling facts, however, is just how far back the relationship between dogs and people goes. Sheep, goats, cattle and pigs, all domesticated between 11,000 and 9,000 years ago during the transition to agriculture, and cats, according to recent research, a mere 4,000 years ago. But dogs stretch back way, way further. A burial at Bonn-Oberskassel in Germany of a young dog alongside two humans is more than 14,000 years old, a time when Homo sapiens was still a hunter and a gatherer. And genetic evidence suggests pre-Columbian American dogs shared an ancestor that lived 23,000 years ago. And a few ambiguous fossils, which some interpret as dogs and others as wolves, are older still than this. Jenny, have you got any comment on... Are you a dog lover? You don't have a dog, do you?
I used to have a dog. My very first dog was given to me when I wasn't really a dog lover at all. It was called Lucky. My dad gave it to me as a surprise in a box.
Ooh, how old were you?
About 10.
Mm. Was that a wise present?
It wasn't a wise gift at all.
Right.
No, I couldn't relate to it in any way whatsoever. It got under my mum's feet in the house. It lived, it was then put outside in a kennel outside the front door.
Ooh.
And started to get very anxious about anybody going in the house, whose ankles it nipped. And then finally, my mum told me it had got run over by a bus, and a little child came running to me when I was playing in the area, and said, "Your dog's been run over. Lucky's been run over." And I was supposed to burst into tears, but I didn't.
Do you think it was run over by a bus?
No, my mum told me many, many years later, she said, "I felt so awful about Lucky." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I really didn't want to put it down."
Oh, God. Lucky, the unlucky.
Mm. Yes. So, but since then, I have had another dog, which my husband went to buy from the shelter. And I ended up looking after it really pretty much on my own for 18 years.
18 years?
Yes, it lived 18 years old. Her name was Chai.
Yeah.
She was beautiful.
Oh,
She got very expensive in the end. She was very naughty at times. I love to... Dearly. But looking after a dog on your own, you know, when you've got a lot going on in your life and not everything is good.
I know, it is a tie.
It is a tie.
It's definitely a tie, yeah. Writing in El País, Nacho Sanchez recounts how Ana Garcia, one of the survivors of the recent tragic train crash near Adamuth, Cordoba, lost her dog, a dog called Borro. Who was travelling on the train.
Yeah.
She survived the crash, although she was with her sister, who was quite badly hurt, and then discovered that her dog wasn't around, yeah, and so she issued a plea for help. And the efforts of dozens of volunteers bore fruit just 4 days after the accident, when Borro was discovered at a neighbouring finca. Gordo, his nickname, "Vamos a casa," said Anna from the back seat of a car as they announced his rescue to a flurry of cameras. Borro, sitting next to his owner, a grey-muzzled schnauzer crossbred with a Spanish water dog, peering at the paparazzi out of the windows. Really, really sweet, really sweet photo. In more general terms, El País goes on to extol how Spanish society increasingly values the emotional bond that joins human beings with their dogs.
Well, I do think they are absolutely beautiful creatures. I love all animals and insects, everything.
Oh, nonsense. You do not love insects, Jenny. Come on.
Well, actually, sometimes I do.
You don't. You have a small barrier outside your kitchen door that I trip over every time I visit
you. Well, that's because I do not want certain ones in my house. Yes, we're not talking about that.
Poor little ants and earwigs can't come and visit you.
all the spiders, all the centipedes and the whole lot and all the woodlouse, you know, it would be teeming with them if I didn't have that there, and it is a horrible way to stop them. But as for dogs, yes, they are very, very special creatures. I love your dog too, Brew. I love my brother's dogs. I love other people's dogs, but I don't want one myself.
All right, fair play, fair play. That brings us to this morning's story, which is about a particular dog. Now, if you've been a long-time listener to TRE, you might recall a Saturday morning programme called Pets, Vets and Guests with Dave the Dogman. 10 years ago, my wife Pen and I used to hot seat with Dave, a bit like we do these days with Giles. Hot seat is when you cross over in the studio in a bit of a rush, which is why we occasionally sound a bit disorganised at the beginning of Encomino.
Because Giles is here.
Well, no, Giles, he does brilliantly. You know, sets up the myriad and all of that. It's just you've got a very short time between coming in, saying, hey, mate, how you doing? Sitting down, the news is on, and then you get the first ad breaks, and if there aren't any mini ads, then you get the and you have to start the show.
And get the seat in the right position and all the microphones on.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. And then, boff, yeah, you're on air. And judging by the phone calls that Dave used to take, Pets, Vets and Guests was a popular listen, so much so that when David was on holiday, in order to counter any withdrawal symptoms, absence of dog chat, I took it upon myself to tell the following story about my English bull terrier. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I will begin.
We are.
Do you share your life with an English bull terrier? If so, I emphasise, because as a breed, they're up there, possibly unrivaled, as the most irresistibly lovable, clownish and monumentally stupid dogs in the world. Whilst they adore the human race, they don't necessarily harbour the same affection for other dogs. Weirdly, Gussie's best friend was our cat, who's called Chili Cow. Gussie, otherwise more formally known as the Bustule, turned 6 last Monday. He has other names too. His kennel name is El Rinoceronte Negro de Montesa Ortana, the Black Rhino of Montesa Ortana. His father, an Irish champion weighing in at 45 kilos, was none other than Ty Bar Troubled Waters. His mother, a resident of the breeders in Castilla-La Mancha, rejoices in the name of Brenda Extremo Bull. These are all kennel names, yeah. Bred in a kennel in this unlikely tumbleweed territory, the Bustule has serious pedigree, and he came with a price tag to match on reflection, me having since been simmed and wizened by the crisis, as well as rescuing other mutts. It's quite unthinkable that one would spend 600 euros on a puppy today, or that we did so then. Though I do know of a miniature long-haired dachshund called Pluto, who cost £3,500 and then required an expensive hip replacement within the first 18 months of his life. Maybe the Bustule was good value after all. The new puppy settled in on his own terms. This was the Bustule. He seemed to lack nerve endings and the rudiments of intelligent fear associated with survival. A mix of boisterous affection and unbiddable indifference. And from day one, I loved him. But at 4 months of age, something was amiss. Well, two things, actually. They were both his ears. They weren't pointy. They were floppy, hanging around the side of his head like a bad hat with flaps. The more I told myself that it didn't really matter, the more I knew that it did. I called Athene, an undisputed authority on English Bull Terriers. She recently had lost hers, a bitch called Daisy, who, in an era of spatial misjudgment during a coastal walk, had jumped off a 40-metre cliff. It was the same lack of intelligent fear essential for survival that I saw in Gus. Whilst remaining deeply knowledgeable and retaining great affection for the breed, Athene confided that Daisy would be her last English Bull Terrier. For the time being, at least, she was looking for a dog that was less of a liability. a lurcher, perhaps. But she was keen to know all about the bustule and was thoroughly entertained by stories of his first few weeks. Casually, I broached the question of his ears, that they were floppy, not pointy. "How old is he?" she said. "Oh, he's about 4 months." "Hmm," said Athene. "They should be standing up by now." Afterwards, reflecting on the conversation, I was discovering something about myself that A, I wasn't proud of, and B, would expose me to ridicule. I wanted my bull terrier, full pedigree Gussie, the black rhino of Montessa Oretana, son of Tybar and Brenda Extremo Bull, to look like an English bull terrier and not like a goat. So, what do you do when you're faced with a problem these days? Well, you Google it, of course. I felt somehow uneasy reading that. Although floppy at first, your baby bull's ears should be standing up on their own after 3 months. And that if they were reluctant, a little help might be required. What sort of help? Say hello to a website from Tennessee or somewhere, definitely deliverance country, where Ma and Pa from someplace deep in the woods breed Dobermans, a number of whom, as puppies, like the bustule, had ears that were erectile dysfunctional. Ma and Pa had developed a system to eliminate floppy ears on Dobermans, all of whom now had ears as pointy sharp as arrows. The apparatus was called the ear brace corrector. I surmised that if they work for Dobermans, why not bull terriers? Covertly, this was not the sort of thing that I wanted friends or enemies to know about. I sent off to Tennessee for a box of ear brace correctors, having supplied Ma and Pa with appropriate dimensions of the bustule's head for the made-to-measure custom fit. Oh, and a sum of money, the exact amount escapes me. Weeks later, having negotiated Spanish excise, a box of 24 EBCs, that's ear brace correctors, arrived, along with a tube of non-injurious adhesive. Let me explain. The ear brace corrector is a taut wire bridge passing over the head of the dog, fixed on each side by a pad which you glue to the inside of the ear, having placed them in the desired upright position. Although not included in the pack from Tennessee, the following instructions were also recommended. Now, bear with me here. Ma and Pa said, "We suggest you try a tampon rolled into each of the pads, glued in place."
I'm really gagging to say something. This is outrageous. I just cannot believe you've done this.
I know, I'm confessing here.
I cannot believe this.
A tampon glued rolled into each of the pads, glued in place, which increased the rigidity of the ear.
Sorry to interrupt. This is all about appearances.
It's about, well, yes, I've explained that.
Okay, just checking.
Now, as you rightly observed, Jenny, there are some things in life that you've done, looking back, that simply beg belief.
Yes, okay.
Did I really do that? Well, of course, the ear brace corrector was an unmitigated failure, a nightmare to install. Have you ever tried gluing tampons to a bull terrier? And once in place, the bustule, like anyone with a degree of self-respect, ran under a bush and removed them almost immediately, certainly within a fraction of the time it had taken to position them. By now, of course, I was talking to my breeder, the guy I bought the bustule from, Jose. What sort of responsibility did he feel for the aesthetic appearance of the super pedigree dog from his kennel? For all he knew, I might want to show Gussie.
True.
Yeah, you know.
There should be some compensation here. Possibly.
Well, not. I'm not looking for compensation. I just want his ears to stand up.
Okay.
So, and here's the Here's the beginning of the happy ending of the saga of the Bustule's ears. You'll be glad to hear the story's nearly over. Jose, the breeder, referred me to the Clinica Veterinaria Vicente in Elche, Alicante, for what he assured me was a routine operation for reluctant ears. A little nip and tuck on a tiny, tiny tendon. Not cheap, but another worthwhile investment. And when I collected Gussie after his five-day internment in Elche, in spite of the protective lampshade around his neck, his ears were perfect.
Oh, cosmetic and surgery for canines.
I wait, they behaved like proper ears. They weren't stuck up all the time. They moved with his mood, like he batted right, them when he was happy to see me.
Oh, he must have been so happy when he looked in the mirror.
The point is, I was happy. He is cooler. He was cooler in summer. He could hear better.
Yes.
And nobody asked, is that a dog or a goat?
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
We were talking earlier about people collecting snow from the mountains and driving back down to the coast. And Giles has very sweetly sent us a message. He says the tradition was to build a snowman on the bonnet of your Seat Leon in Ronda and then drive stupidly fast down to San Pedro with a snowman still on the front of the car.
Brilliant.
Much better than shoveling it into the boot. Yeah. So it's time to look back into our past, which we do occasionally. In fact, we do a lot of on this programme.
We do.
Way back before the invention of the electric blanket, folk used to use hot rocks to warm up their beds. We're talking about warming up your bed, yeah? But then people got bored with stubbing their toes on hot rocks and invented the bedpan. No, not that sort of bedpan. You know, embarrassment in hospital. But the copper pan filled with hot coals on a long pole that your manservant inserted between the sheets before bedtime. But then came the hot water bottle. And Jenny, you've been doing some research on the history of the hot water bottle.
Well, I love my hot water bottle. I mean, this has been some winter, hasn't it? And I mean, if you don't have central heating and you just, or in your bedroom, for example.
Or an electric blanket.
You
don't have an electric blanket.
I love my hot water bottle. Do you have one?
I don't have a hot water bottle. You know what? The thing with hot water bottles is that they don't stay hot. They are cold and clammy in the morning, and it's like waking up with a sort of frigid bladder.
Well, that's because you don't have a cover on your hot water bottle.
True, you should have a cover, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember them. What colour's your cover?
Pink and furry.
Oh, lovely.
And actually, I remember from boarding school days, lining up with the other girls down in the basement of the boarding house, waiting for matron to appear with an enormous kettle of boiling water. And we'd line up and have our hotties filled for us and stop it.
I'm imagining. You'd already be holding out your...
We were. It was a very special time and we were very patient and there was something terribly snuggly about it because our bedrooms were freezing. But anyhow, the hot water heating up your bed has been a thing for a very, very long time. They were even found that there were some clay artifacts found from the pre-Roman days, from between the 1st and 3rd century before Christ, and during Egyptian times.
Really?
Absolutely.
The Egyptians had hot water bottles?
Well, they had these things that were first thought of as just vessels for containing liquids, but it turned out from the design of them that they figured out these were actually for heating up or putting hot materials inside, not necessarily water, because I don't know how well they were stoppered, to use for ailments by apothecaries and doctors and to soothe the bones or whatever. Little vessels that are beautifully shaped and very, very unusual. And there are examples of these in the Ashmolean in Oxford and the National Museum of Athens, where they hold these examples of clay vessels. And some of these, as I say, they date back thousands of years. It's quite wonderful, I think. Anyway, since then, they did then, as you say, start using these hot pans in beds, sort of more around the sort of 18th, 19th century. And then in the 19th century, the invention of a bottle for containing water made of Indian rubber came in.
Mm-hmm.
So we're
and that is recognisably what we recognise today as a hot water bottle.
That's right. And before then, you know, you could have something put in your bed containing either ash, as you said before, you know, warm coals, not so much water because that was more of a problem, but they did make vessels out of clay with stoppers in them which would be put into the bed. But obviously you don't want to, you know, lie in your bed with a piece of stone in it, effectively. And these were made from wood, copper, even glass, clay, stoneware, all sorts of things. But the, as I say, in the 19th century, it was, in fact, in 1875, I think, that they, by then, they were starting to use these rubber bottles. And there was an inventor who patented what we now know as the contemporary water bottle. And he was a Croatian man whose name I can't see here. Croatian inventor Slavoj Jub Penkala. In 1903, he patented what we currently use.
1903. Oh, wow. It's endured, hasn't it?
It really has.
That's a long time.
It is a very long time.
Well done, Slabo.
Well done him. But also, do you know, in my research, I found this thing called the hot water bottle blowing practice.
Blowing practice.
Yes, the hot water bottle blowing practice. There's actually a records in the Guinness Book of Records have challenges are set up for these people to blow up hot water bottles either with their mouth or with their nose until they explode with their nose. Yes, you heard me right. I need and this activity
until they explode.
Know, yes. It presents a potential hazard for physical injury, both to the eyes and the lungs, apparently, and some people have died in the process. Blowing up a hot water bottle is usually performed to impress a crowd. It requires significant, as you can imagine, lung capacity, massive, as well as chest and abdominal strength. It is regarded as potentially hazardous because of the risk of harm to the eyes and the possibility of the contained air rushing back into the lungs and causing damage or reportedly death.
Wow.
Former
bad blowback, that
yes,
would be called.
Absolutely. Former world record holder Brian Jackson has claimed that he knows of at least 5 deaths resulting from the practice, although this is unconfirmed. Georgian athlete Jemel Tsikhalavi has demonstrated 2 variations on the traditional method, blowing the bottle up with his nose and blowing one up while somebody sits on top of it.
Never.
Absolutely. I mean, the things people do. I mean, really, there are 3 hot water bottle blowing records officiated by the Guinness World Records. The fastest hot water bottle burst by a male is held by Sean Jones from the United Kingdom. He achieved a time of 6.52 seconds.
Wow.
And on the set of an Italian show on the 31st of March 2011, Jones also holds the record for the fastest time to burst 3 hot water bottles, setting the time of 28.82 seconds on the 17th of November 2011. And it goes on.
Wow. Amazing, Jenny. Well, fantastic research, darling. I'm really, that's fantastic. Look, there is another way of keeping warm, as we're talking about dogs on this programme. The 23,000-year relationship between a man and his dogs can take place at night in bed.
Oh, no, please.
No, this is not grim, don't worry. It's just basically bedroom symbiosis. Enjoyed particularly by Brian Sewell and his dogs. And in the prelude of his book, which is actually called Sleeping with Dogs, Brian says, old habits die hard. Bedrooms in my boyhood were chill places, heated only at times of illness and grudgingly. Even then, beds were chilled too, with heavy sheets of ancient inherited linen icy against the skin and woolen blankets so weighty that my small body was pressed into the mattress. In winter, there was no such thing as falling asleep the moment one's head touched the pillow. And for the first 5 minutes between the sheets were spent shivering and shuddering with cold as they sap the heat from one's body, unless one had a dog. Or a hot water bottle, I suppose, gradually, but he doesn't say
it's
that.
It's the same sort of thing, really, isn't it?
Except it my dog called Prince before the war, he slept on my bed. Penny, in the bitter winters of the late 40s, slept in it, radiating the igloo, as it were, and cuddling her meant that my front was warm as toast, no matter how clammy cold my back and far-off feet might be. Susie slept both on and in my bed when I was seriously ill, judging my temperature, pressing against me to absorb the pain. I've ever since slept with all my dogs, one, two, three or four at a time, waking, as I always do, with the not quite dawn, but often making no attempt to leave my bed. So luxuriously seductive is the warmth on all sides. For an hour and more, I've lain in this cocoon at least 10,000 times, ignoring the insistent thoughts of coffee and the working day, mindlessly drifting in and out of sleep as immobilized by my companions as if by anesthesia. This, when the time comes, is how I wish to die.
Oh, that's actually quite a nice ending there, I think.
Yeah, well, actually, it's not the ending. It's a prelude to this book, and it's called Sleeping with Dogs, and it's an anthology of all the dogs this guy has ever owned. They're called things like Schubert, Gamage and Spinoza, Trollope. There's a dog called Trollope, Mopaswesta, Mospus, Mopsy and Mop. I think that's the same dog, actually.
You've had a lot of dogs, haven't you?
We have had a lot of dogs.
Good old series of them.
And the dog that I have at the moment, Brewy, he has developed a habit of barging into the bedroom at about 3 a.m, in which case I do, like Brian Sewell, he comes to bed with me.
Does he?
And actually, do you know what? He's a good sleeping companion as long as he doesn't take over my side of the bed. And what I love about him is his breathing. We can synchronize our breathing, and he doesn't have a sort of high hyper breathing, but it's a long kind of in out, okay, in out, like the seashore. You know?
Okay, that's I was thinking about that, but so you don't keep him awake with your snoring.
I don't keep him awake with my snoring, no.
No.
I don't think anything keeps him awake.
Okay, and he sleeps on the bed, not in it.
He sleeps on the bed.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
yeah,
that's something. I suppose that's acceptable.
So that's our dogs. And finally, because we're nearly out of time, eating. I've got this notes on eating alone by Hannah Tomes, writing in The Spectator. And she says, to some, the phrase "table for one, please" is among the saddest in the English language. Perhaps it isn't a surprise. The concept of social dining for pleasure dates back to ancient Greece. And there, meals would be served at an all-male gathering on low tables so that the guests could recline while eating, a recipe for heartburn, but luxurious nonetheless. And then would come the symposium, the section of the evening dedicated to drinking. Although we mix the two with a little more fluidity now, the concept is much the same. Sharing a meal and drinks with others is an enjoyable thing to do, so people do it. I mean, do you eat alone, Janie? When you go out, do you eat alone?
I will sometimes have a breakfast, yes, on my own.
Yeah, breakfast.
Yeah.
But do you ever go out to dinner on your own?
Never. Never done that. Unless I've been, away travelling somewhere, and you stay in a hotel or or somewhere like that.
Yes. And do you take a book with you or something to distract yourself?
I would sometimes take a book, but I know I'm not going to read it. So I've now become more comfortable with the idea of actually just sitting there observing.
Nice. Yeah, right. Rather than gazing at your phone or...
Yeah, I'm looking at all the other people scrolling. Who are looking at their phones. But, I mean, food and stuff, you know, I was just... As you were starting to talk about that, I was thinking about we might go on to mention something about plants, but we haven't got enough time.
We don't have time, Janie, because look... Oh, my goodness, it's 30 seconds to midday.
Yes, and I wanted to say I've been driving over avocados.
Driving over avocados.
There we go.
Squirge. All right, that's it for now. It's been lovely having your company. I hope you've enjoyed the programme. And I wish you a very happy weekend.
Happy weekend, everybody.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.